Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, back from a very exciting trip to Des Moines, Iowa. Yes, it can be very exciting in America's heartland. Before I talk a little bit about my trip there and about an upcoming conference, you know, before I do what I usually do at the start of my show, which is a little chat about interesting things, I'm going to do a little teaser on my guest because he's very special and unusual. And before bringing him on the air, I want to tell you a little bit about his book, Doing Harm. It's a novel by Kelly Parsons. And here's what the ad says. Stephen Mitchell, happily married with a wife and two kids, is in line for a coveted position at Boston's University Hospital when his world goes awry. His overreaching ambition causes him to botch a major surgery, and another of his patients mysteriously dies. Steve's nightmare goes from bad to worse when he learns that the mysterious death was no accident, but the act of a psychopath. A sociopath, rather, I should say. And a sociopath whom he knows and who has information that could destroy Steve's career and marriage. And for this man, it's a game. Well, Kelly Parsons will be on in about 5 minutes, but I'm going to tell you a little more even before he comes on. My wife is reading his book. It's as gripping as it's described. And it has marvelous endorsements. Now, Ginger's the novel writer, reader, rather, the novel reader in the family. She often just carries a novel with her, like her dad used to do, wherever she goes. And she tells me that the endorsements on this book are from people to die for, to endorse your book. One is from Harlan Coben. He's the author of 6 Years. And he says, Doing Harm is a terrific medical thriller. Another is from somebody I had heard of, Ridley Pearson, author of Point. And he, too, gives an outstanding intro, endorsement for the book, and others I might read to you as we go along. It's going to be fun to talk to a doctor who's written his first novel. And he's also an expert in safety concerns in medicine. And I want to find out from him, well, how much did that influence your scientific studies of safety concerns influence this novel? And I'm hoping we will be able to talk about both novel and safety concerns. Now, for my usual intro. I had a marvelous time in Des Moines, Iowa. I spent 2 days giving workshops on therapy and counseling and on adverse drug effects to St. Gregory's Retreat. Now, if you have or know somebody who has a drug problem, an alcohol problem, and also in combination with that, a psychiatric drug problem, this place, St. Gregory's, actually acknowledges that psychiatric drugs are a problem. It's run by Rosemary and Mike Vasquez. I really love these people. They start by taking the individual off with a taper and nutritional support, taking the individual off all drugs. So when you go to St. Gregory's in Des Moines, Iowa, you have to agree to not only want to be off your alcohol and your heroin and whatever else you're doing, you have to agree to come off your psychiatric drugs. And they do that in a very short-term, intensive manner. The trip took a little toll on my respiratory system. Over a 10-day period of intensive medical attention, And then you go into the women into one residential place and the men into another for 2 months and then occasionally for more, where you get spiritually oriented, not 12-step, spiritually oriented. You can go through it without being a Christian, a Catholic, or a Jew, but it's definitely God-oriented program that really looks at you as a spiritual being, as a soul, not just a mechanical brain, and that presents you with the challenge not of getting well, but of living a really good, loving, spiritual life. Needless to say, I got along marvelously, and I'm hoping to continue to work with this group. And again, if you've got a drug or an alcohol problem, I think this is a very good place to look into. Make up your mind about it. I'm just really pleased to see how around the country more and more people are becoming aware that psychiatric drugs are hardly what's been promised. Now, coming up soon, you can come and hear me talk directly, as well as a marvelous array of people on children, ADHD, drugs, families, better approaches. It's a conference that's going to be held October 29th and 30th in Syracuse. We're co-sponsoring, but it's really run by Michael Gilbert. Michael Gilbert's group is It's About Childhood and Family. And you can probably get to it most directly by going to It's Childhood and Family. It's About Childhood and Family. I'm going to be there both days, the Wednesday and the Thursday, participating. And on Thursday, I'm going to run that day and be the MC and bring together a group of really interesting exciting people. Look it up. Come. Say hello. Tell me you heard about it on the radio show. And now for my guest. Are you there, Kelly?
I'm here. Yes, Peter.
Did I give you a good enough intro?
Well, yes, thank you. You were very generous.
It's not generous. It's actually true. My wife is reading the book and enjoying it. Says it's a very gripping thriller. You do have marvelous endorsements for the book. Now, Kelly is a board-certified urologist. You are the second board-certified urologist I've had on the show. I've had another on a couple of occasions who's been talking about, his name is Urato, U-R-A-T-O. He's been talking about birth defects from Paxil. He's a very, very brave urologist, good man. Kelly's a board-certified urologist. He's got degrees from the worst possible places, from my viewpoint, Stanford University, University of Pennsylvania, and Johns Hopkins. Places that are great medical places, but the problem with great medical places nowadays is that they're usually doing the worst of modern psychiatry. He's on the faculty of the University of California at San Diego, and he lives with his wife and his family in Southern California. And as I mentioned earlier, it's his first novel. Hi, take off on whatever direction you want to go with your novel, with safety concern issues, and let's get started.
Well, thank you so much. And Peter, thank you so much for having me on the show today. I really appreciate it. I'm very grateful. And I was very pleased with the introduction. Thank you. The only thing I'll add is an endorsement that we got after the fact. We had Stephen King, who apparently we were able to find out later, saw the book in his local bookstore, thought it looked interesting, picked it up, took it home, read it, and then Stephen King tweeted to his hundreds of thousands of followers that it was the, quote, best damn medical thriller that he had read in 25 years. And so that was absolutely exhilarating and indescribable for me when that happened. Because I've been such a great admirer of him, and he's one of the reasons why I started writing long ago, just back when I was just a kid. And I think what writing has been for me, my own personal journey, has been that it has allowed me to weld together my two passions, my passions being medicine and writing. And so fiction writing, and fiction writing specifically about doctors and the hospital environment and healthcare has been a way for me to express some of the things that I experience or have experienced in the other realm of my life, the other passion. And doing harm, as you alluded to, is the story of a young surgeon. He's a resident still, so he's not quite a fully trained surgeon yet. And I think that Steve, in general, is a good guy. And I think, though, that he's lost his way a little bit. He's become a little bit arrogant. He's become a little bit overly confident in his own skills. He's, I think, become a little bit dismissive of the patients, and he's forgotten the reason why he went to medical school in the first place. And for him, the surgery and the execution of the surgery has become more important than the actual care of the patients or listening to the patient's stories and simply putting a hand on their shoulder and telling them that he's with them through the journey no matter what happens. And he ends up making some poor choices and quickly finds himself unexpectedly under a cloud of suspicion when a number of very mysterious deaths occur in the hospital in which he works. And he is actually tied up in these deaths in a little in certain ways, and I don't want to reveal too much because there are a lot of twists and turns, and I don't want to give out any spoilers. He is involved in these deaths in certain ways, but is tied to them in very unexpected ways that become revealed over the course of the story. And yes, it does turn into a cat and mouse game ultimately between him and a killer who is exploiting the hospital for reasons that become apparent during the course of the story to further their own career and to take advantage of helpless patients who are in the hospital. And
have you had
the
any
way
movie
that
right
patient
the
safety,
bids?
I do know that. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Have you had any movie right bids on this? Because this sounds like a great movie, too.
We actually have. The movie rights have been optioned.
Not surprised.
The first step in the process, I have discovered, because it's a completely different line of work, the entertainment industry, than what I've been exposed to previously. The first step to having a movie or a TV or some kind of film medium or translation into the film medium occur is what's called an option, which means that an individual or some kind of entity options the rights, and that means that they have a certain period of time in which to start production on a movie or a TV show. And when that time elapses, then the book comes back up for option, and they can either re-option it for a certain period of time, or the book can then be placed back essentially on the market for folks who might be interested in optioning it. So that first step has been taken. It's been optioned by an actor and a producer by the name of Joel McHale. So if any of your listeners watch The Soup on TV or they watch the NBC show Community, he is the star of both of those shows. He's also done a little bit of producing, and he's also been an actor, a supporting actor in some more serious movies. And so he's very interested in the book, and so we'll see what happens with it from here.
This is so exciting. God, you must just, you know, I think about your description of Stephen King. It sounds to me like something I might have dreamed and waked up from, you know.
Yeah. Yes, and I was really worried that was going to happen.
Oh,
yes, it was completely unexpected and absolutely delightful when that happened. And he does that from time to time. He discovers books. He's a voracious reader, and he discovers books. Mm-hmm. And he's very kind and generous, I think, in that sense of supporting younger, newer writers, and giving them that kind of exposure, which has just been absolutely tremendous.
Didn't he have a terrible accident a few years ago? Is he recovered and is he writing again and everything?
Yes, he did. He had a horrible accident. He was hit while he was walking on the side of the road, and he very eloquently describes the entire experience of being seriously injured and then recovering from it in a book called On Writing, A Memoir of the Craft. And that came out, about 12 or 14 years ago now, I think. And it's an absolutely fantastic book. If there's anyone in your audience who is a writer or a budding writer, I highly recommend it. It's a very personal account of his struggle, actually, with this very, very serious injury, and all of the operations he had to endure and everything else. And he writes very, very poignantly about it. And I think at some point he describes in great detail the individual who hit him. And I seem to recall at one point in the book he rather ironically notes that he had been hit by a character from out of one of his books, the way he described it. So,
wow, you know, I suspect that one of the things that my audience has as a secret wish, many of them, is to write a novel. I actually, folks don't probably know, and I'm not urging them to learn more about it, but I wrote a couple of novels from good publishers way back in the early 70s before it became very clear what my purpose in life was, and it wasn't writing fiction. I'm sure that a lot of folks in the health field, and a lot of my listeners are going to be people who have been doing therapy or doing reform issues or have been through a lot of tragedy with psychiatry. And I've been an awful lot of my audiences thinking, boy, I'd like to write my novel, my story. Did you train for this? Did you take courses? How did you go about writing your first novel?
I did not train for it. I did not take courses. I don't have a master's in creative writing or a master of fine arts or anything like that. I just started writing. Writing was something that I had always wanted to do, and I read a lot, and I read books on the craft like Stephen King's and gleaned from them some advice about structure and storytelling, but mostly gleaned from them the advice that in order to write well, you have to read a lot and you have to write a lot. And so when I first started on this journey, it was actually a little bit along the lines of what you just mentioned, Peter. I was in my residency, and residency is a very intense experience, as you know, and it can be challenging, I think, for young doctors out of medical school or even in medical school, because that's when they really start to get exposed to things that they might not have ever been exposed before to, traumas and very, very ill patients and end-of-life decisions and all these different things that can be very challenging for a young person to process. And I was exposed to all these in my 20s, and I think one of the ways that I processed it, that I was able to deal with it, was that I just started writing, and I didn't keep a journal per se, but I would jot down observations here and there, and I then when I finished, or toward the end of my training rather, my training was 8 years total, and in the seventh year of my training, I had a little bit of breathing room, and I was able to sit down and start putting some of the notes together and start writing. And my goal was really just to write and to feel like I was accomplishing something by writing and to eventually have something that had a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I didn't envision, for example, writing a medical thriller. That just kind of happened. And in fact, actually, it didn't even happen initially. What transpired was that once I did have a novel with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it wasn't a medical thriller really at the time, I sent it around to different agents, and same old story that a lot of writers will tell, numerous rejections, and most folks not even really returning any of my correspondence or inquiries. And then after about 2 years of that, I did have an agent, my wonderful agent now, Al Zuckerman, who read my manuscript and was willing to take me on and work with me. And at the time, he said, well, you know, what you've begun to write here is a medical thriller, and I think one of the things that we have to do is to fashion it more so in structure as a medical thriller, which is what we ended up happening. And it's an interesting genre to be in, I guess, medical thriller. It's originally my publisher, my editor, who is also now my publisher, she described it as a dilemma thriller with medical elements. So she would say, well, this is a thriller, and it's a what would I do if I were in this position kind of a story, where you're thrown into this situation that this young doctor is, and you kind of think to yourself in the back of your mind as you're reading it, well, geez, he's doing this, what would I do? So she likes to think of it as a dilemma thriller, but then when all was said and done and it came out, it's really slotted so nicely into the medical thriller genre that's how we're describing it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And it's published by St. Martin's Press.
Yes.
Which published my bestseller, Talking Back to Prozac, and also published Toxic Psychiatry and Medication Madness. So we have St. Martin's in common. It would be fun to know if we know people in common there, but that can wait another day. Now, it's really important, this idea that you had a lot of rejections. You know, the publishing industry, especially right now, is very sick and having a lot of trouble, and it's especially hard to break into it. And I think it should, though, be an inspiration to people that, you know, whether you're talking about publishing or anything else that you want to do, going into business, becoming a professional person, being an artist, there's usually a lot of rejection in the process of anything that's creative. And boy, you know, you got to deal with your shame issues. You got to not let yourself get overcome with humiliation. I think that's probably the greatest barrier there is to becoming creative. And congratulations for you persisting through it. Did you have encouragement from your wife or friends?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Well, from the very few people who knew, it wasn't something that I told a lot of people because it was a very personal experience for me. It was very private.
Right.
And when I entered into it, I was doing it more than anything for myself. I wanted to prove to myself that I could write a book with a beginning, middle, and an end that was coherent, that you could read, and it all made sense at the end of it. And my wife was the one person who knew about it the longest. For quite some time, she was the only one who knew about it, in fact. And she provided a lot of encouragement and patience and a lot of very critical, astute feedback, too. And so that was very, very helpful. And I think what you say about rejection is very true. I think you can't take anything personally. And when you enter into these kinds of creative endeavors, and I completely agree that it doesn't matter if it's in science or art or business, when you enter into a creative endeavor, you have to be passionate about it. And it's the passion that will keep you coming back even after people tell you that your idea is horrible or your story is horrible. And you get knocked down and you don't feel like getting back up again. It's your passion that will drive you, I think, to get back up again. And I reached at one point, I think, with my novel, I reached one point where I said, well, gosh, you know, I've got this book and I've worked pretty hard on it and I'm pretty proud of it. And, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen? Everybody will say no, and I'll find out a way to self-publish, because you can, of course, do that these days. And so there was a point when I was you know, in the back of my mind considering that. But then again, I was also just quite pleased that I had written this book that I was proud of, that even if it had never been published, I had made it, and I had fashioned it and crafted it and put all these hours into it, and there it was, and here was something that existed that had never existed before.
Did you ever excuse me? Again, folks, I apologize. I'm afraid to press my mute button when I cough, because the last time I did that, I forgot I'd pressed it a few years ago, and it was very disruptive. So I'm coughing to the side rather than pressing my mute button here. Did you ever take a course in writing, formal or informal of any kind?
I did not, actually. I considered taking creative writing in college. They had a very popular entry-level course, so popular, in fact, that at the time you had to camp out outside the registrar's office in order to get into it. And I didn't do it. And I didn't do it because I was afraid that I would be in a room full of really smart, really talented people, and they would tell me that what I was writing was no good. And, you know, what can I say? I was younger, and I wasn't at a point yet in my life where I was willing to write something in a very public kind of way and put it out there and to just take my lumps, come what may.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who do take writing courses, some of them get a lot of encouragement. But again, it's a big risk to take a writing course because just as you got all those rejections from editors, or rather agents in the beginning, and maybe some editors along the way who just didn't get it. They didn't get who you were and who you could become. They didn't get what Zuckerman got, which was, okay, this is a stage it's at. It could be fabulous. So when you get rejected out there, folks, hey, you know, sure, self-search if you think it's worth it, but you're just running into other people and their own anxieties and their own frustrations and their own misconceptions. I just want to encourage all of you to, if you want to write. And it's a pleasure to have you on the show. I mean, it's a miracle that you're doing so well, and I'm sure a tribute to the writing as well. When we come back, we're going to take a break, but not for maybe 3 or 4 minutes. I'd like to try to get a little bit into what in your medical experience may have led you to go in these directions, or was it just reading Stephen King? Did you, out of your medical experiences, get a sense of the potential evil in human nature, the potential destructiveness that people in power like us physicians have? Or did it more come from your reading? You want to start that conversation now?
Well, I mean, I think it came more from my reading. I didn't personally, during my training, and nor have I since, to my knowledge, in my practice, encountered somebody, say, for example, with a mental health issue who was violent or somehow mentally ill in a way in which their illness compelled them to harm others. Of course, read about such things, and there are reports reports in the media that have been made about nurses in particular. There was one nurse who was convicted of murder, and they were going around, I believe, chronic care facilities and euthanizing folks in chronic care facilities. And so that is something that is a theme that is explored in the book. So I was interested in the capacity potentially for someone who was a caregiver to instead be someone who takes that power that has been entrusted in them, takes that power and twists it around, and so that instead of healing people, they're in fact hurting them. And that's where the title of the book comes from. So the
book is Doing Harm Again.
Correct. So the classic phrase, of course, is do no harm. First, do no harm. And the doing harm part comes from the idea that, well, actually, physicians are in a position, physicians, any healthcare provider, really, whether it's a physician or a physician assistant or a nurse, is in a position where they actually can do harm, can do great harm to people. Because when we enter the healthcare system, whether that's by walking into a doctor's office or a hospital or being wheeled into an operating room, we are entrusting ourselves in the hands of other people. And other people who have great training and mean the very, very best, and they love what they do, but they are human beings in the end. And so I wanted to explore some of the themes related to that and how that could affect people in potentially negative ways. And it's an interesting theme because I think it's a common theme. So when I'm speaking in groups, for example, about the book, one of the first things I'll ask to a group of people is I'll say, okay, how many people in this room have ever been or currently are a patient? And of course, everybody in the room's hand goes up, including myself. So it's a common experience that we all have, that we routinely trust others with one of the most precious things that we have, and that's our health. And so it's a common thread that I think people are attracted to when they read the book, because it's also, in being a common thread, it's also a common anxiety. I hate going to the doctor. I can't stand going to the doctor, and I am a doctor. And I think that a lot of people feel that way. You'd rather have your teeth pulled, although I guess that's kind of like going to the doctor too, because you're going to the dentist. But there's so many other things that you would rather do than have to go in to see the doctor or have a procedure done or anything else, even though we know it's something that we should do, that we must do, because it's for our health.
Kelly Parsons, we're going to go to break now. And we're talking to Kelly Parsons, physician, urologist, and author of Doing Harm. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, and my guest, a very interesting man, Kelly Parsons, who is a urologist and the author of his first novel, Doing Harm, which has already had a marvelous endorsement from Stephen King, as well as from many others. It's a medical thriller, and my wife, who does all the novel reading for me, is well into the book and thinks it's a really exciting medical thriller. So this is an exciting book. During break, I shared with Kelly some of my experiences with medical harm during my training and my internship, and this is separate from psychiatry, which was doing harm all the time. I found in general that in medical school, in my training, that doctors as a group are really ethical and really concerned about the well-being of their patients. I honestly did not find that in psychiatry. I found that people were preoccupied with their drugs and shock treatment, and a doctor could be a psychoanalyst who, when the psychoanalysis didn't go well, could send his patient for a shock treatment. I didn't find that same quality, which is really a terrible tragedy, of concern and care in the psychiatric community during my training as I did in the medical. But nonetheless, I saw some really terrible things happen that were covered up in just my brief exposure as a medical student. I saw at least two botched surgeries at the local VA, one in which a patient died afterward, and the family was never told what happened, and I've never spoken about this before, actually. It's many years back, and I saw another surgery where a mistake was made, which could potentially over the years affect a young man, might or might not, and he was never told. I saw a massive overdose of hypertensive drug, which I actually tried to stop. I mean, I stood up to the chief of medicine and said, you can't. You want to give this much reserpine to this patient for his blood pressure crisis? And he's basically, practically he just blew me off. And then we had to treat an acute case of overdose with hypotension for the next few days while the drug wore off. So, I mean, I did see things being covered up where the patient and the family weren't told. And I wonder, and again, I also want to put this in the context of my overall experience. I was at a very good school, it's now called Case Western Reserve, I had, in general, a great respect for many of the physicians I worked with in medicine and pediatrics and surgery. Kelly, you think times have changed? Are doctors being more open and honest?
I think so. I think in the broadest sense, that has not been my experience during my training. It hasn't been my experience during my practice that folks look to cover things up. If anything, there's a culture actually of transparency now that I think has been spurred by many things. One of those was the report that came out that the Institute of Medicine, which is a very prominent group of preeminent scientists, published several years ago a report that said that hundreds of thousands of patients were dying every year in the United States through mistakes that had really nothing or very little to do with their actual illness. And so that the report was called To Err is Human, and it caused a great uproar and a lot of soul-searching, I think, in the medical community. And since then, there's been a lot of research and interest in trying to improve patient safety and to try to understand errors when they do occur, because one of the first steps to preventing an error is to admit that errors occur, and they will occur, and to identify the error and to identify the factors that cause the error to occur. And so I think that in my own personal experience, in my own personal experience, but also in the broader experience, I think, of American medicine right now, I do think that there is a lot of transparency in our hospital system. There's a culture very much of if a mistake is made, then we are ethically and morally bound to be transparent about it, and to not hide it, to not sweep it under the rug and hope nobody notices, but to deal with it transparently, and more importantly perhaps even than that, to understand the factors that led up to it, and to try to prevent that from ever occurring again.
Now, when you say transparent, does that include telling the patient or the surviving family?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, I hope you're right. I know that in our case, my wife had a really serious surgical injury that I have no reason to believe was ever investigated, nor were we told about the circumstances surrounding it until I looked into it myself. But to err is human. Human nature leaves so much, as your book, I'm sure, describes. Human nature leaves so much to be desired, and we work on improving our systems, and we work on it. You've been doing actual research on safety issues, haven't you?
Yes. And in fact, one of the basic tenets of safety research and of making hospitals safer environments is to first start with the fundamental assumption that every system in which humans are directly involved is going to have errors in it, because human beings make errors. And if you start with that fundamental assumption and then build a system from that fundamental assumption that humans are going to make errors, and you have to assume that they're going to make errors, then you can build a system that takes error into account. And by taking error into account becomes a safer system. So I think a common example in my life, at least, is when you go to the gas station and you have that one pump that's designated for diesel fuel and all the other pumps for regular non-diesel fuel. And it would be very easy. You could see if you're in a hurry and you're not paying attention that you could just pick up that diesel pump and put it right in your tank, and pretty soon you've ruined your engine because you've put diesel fuel in a non-diesel engine. And if that pump, the diesel pump, looks just like the non-diesel pumps, that's a very easy kind of a thing to occur. It's a very easy error to make, especially if you're rushing through or if it's night and you can't see well, or you've got people honking because you're taking too long to fill up your gas tank. All of those things can happen and drive that single error of putting the wrong gas into the gas tank. And of course, you can hit yourself over the head and say, you know, how could I have been so stupid? How could that have happened? But you could see where pretty much any rational individual under a certain set of circumstances could easily fill their tank with the wrong kind of gas. And so what do? Well, you put the diesel pump away from the other ones. You somehow color it. You somehow say only for diesel engines in bright fluorescent letters. You do everything you can to allow people, even the people who are harried and in a hurry and the cars are honking and they're just trying to get home, even people in that situation, you cause them to pause just for a second with the pump in their hand and say, oh, wait a second, this is diesel. I'm not supposed to use this in my car. I'm going to ruin my engine. So I think that's a very common example, or potentially a common example of everyday sorts of happenings, that is an example of a system that can be set up to prevent an assumed rate of human error that's going to occur. And the same thing can happen in medicine. There can be all sorts of safeguards that are built into a system to account for the kinds of things that can happen on a busy hospital floor, for example. You know, hospitals are extraordinarily busy places, and things happen unexpectedly. Sickness is not predictable. Diseases are not predictable. People's bodies are not always completely predictable, especially in the context of an illness, and things can happen very, very quickly. And so if you set up a system that is geared toward preventing error even before it occurs, simply because you know it might occur, and takes into account that we are frail, fragile humans who are prone to error, then you can build a safer system.
I'm really, really glad there is more attention going to that. But I just realized that I mentioned that my wife had a surgical injury, and a lot of people who listen to the show know and love Ginger. And that was 5 years ago. So she has, and she has recovered after a lot of pain from this injury. But she's recovered from it. I didn't want folks thinking, oh, my God, Ginger's been hurt. So we're fine, folks. We're doing good. What have you published? What field have you published in regard to the safety issues?
I've been very interested in surgical safety primarily. I've been interested in different ways that different technologies can influence how safe a procedure is.
And so, what do? You how do you study that? You sound like you're reluctant to talk about your research.
Well,
we don't have to push on this, but I'm very interested. I said we don't have to push on the research subject, but I'm very interested. I know you haven't talked much about your research, but I'd love to hear what you're trying to do. But we can go back to the novel if not.
Well, it's to me it's fun stuff. It's very interesting, and I think it's an important service that we attempt to do for the public health and to serve the public in trying to determine ways that that new technologies can influence the particular safety of a particular surgery. The way that we've gone about it is the way that a lot of scientists go about it. We take large databases. So we look at large groups of patients, primarily in government-run databases. And so these are what are called claims data. They're run by various branches of health and human services, and they collect anonymous data on people's diseases when they're in the hospital, and that includes surgeries. And there are different databases that you can access. There is, for example, what's called the Medicare database that looks at folks who have been in the hospital and have utilized Medicare. There are other databases that look at cancer patients. And again, these are all anonymous. They're all ways of having data that are completely untraceable to individual patients. And it enables scientists, researchers, to look at large groups of patients anonymously very quickly, relatively quickly, and to pose certain questions after the fact. So I think your listeners might think of traditional medical research as a research trial or a clinical trial where you have a pill, for example, and which I know you talk a lot about on your show, but you have a pill, and let's call it a high blood pressure pill, as you were just mentioning with one of your stories, and you want to test the high blood pressure pill, and the FDA wants to know, is this high blood pressure pill going to work? And so folks sign up for the research study, and a coin gets flipped, essentially. It's flipped by the computer, but a coin gets flipped, and somebody gets assigned the pill, somebody gets assigned a sugar pill, perhaps a placebo, and then a certain period of time goes by, and the scientists and doctors measure whether or not the blood pressure is effectively lowered, whether or not the pill helps. I think that's the research. That's the kind of research study that most people are familiar with. These other kinds of research studies that we do are kind of an indirect way of looking at things. And so because we're looking at research that has already on patients who have already been in the hospital and left the hospital, then it happens after the fact. And so it's a way of looking at trends shortly after the trends have occurred and try to project new trends in the future.
Yeah, there have been studies like that, Kelly, in psychiatry that have been very useful. A study of one big insurance database, for example, showed that treatment for manic episodes frequently followed treatment with antidepressants. And they were able to do that and break it out for age groups and show that it happened frequently with children, but also in all ages, and gave us an ability to once again say, hey, these drugs cause mania and have, you know, in a very significant number of patients. That's the kind of study you're talking about, to some extent?
Yes. They're very exactly the kind of study that we're talking about. And they're very useful studies because they can be done safely. They can be done maintaining people's privacy because, again, these are completely anonymous databases, and they can be used to screen large groups of patients very quickly. So they can be done efficiently, and they can be done cheaply. And they can really provide a lot of information that otherwise you wouldn't be able to get. And so in the case of your study, I think that's a perfect example of detecting something after the fact and finding a potentially very important trend that you might not have otherwise seen, especially with just individuals or even groups of individuals.
The VA did a database study where they they looked at the suicide attempts, and went back and then looked at what drugs happened immediately beforehand and so on, and they were able to make an association with SSRIs in all age groups, which was very important. Very important because the FDA was only really most strongly warning about age 24 and younger, and that is one great benefit of these databases. Do you see a danger in where we're going now? This may be out of your field. Tell me if it's out of your field. But we're starting to have now, under the new healthcare programs, just large databases are going to be developed with whole records in them, as I understand, that can be accessed from any place in the country if you have the proper key. I mean, here in New York State, we already have a database where any doctor can go in and look up whether you what your record is on taking on getting prescriptions for narcotics. So if Betty comes in to see me with no more than Betty's birthday and my passcode, I can find out whether Betty's gotten any recent prescriptions for narcotics. I can look at her recent history. Do you see dangers in this? Have you been looking into this?
Well, I think, and I just want to append your comment before that, just really quickly, because you mentioned the VA and what sounds to me to be a very important VA study. I work at the VA. We have a VA associated with our university, and I think that it sounds like that VA study was very important, and I do think that, unfortunately, the VA does get some bad press from a very small group of rotten apples and a very huge basket of very, very good apples, because I think that the VA really, really does so many very good things. I just want to put in that plug, because I meet so many extraordinary men and women who are absolutely dedicated to the health care of the vets every day. I really think that they go above and beyond in providing outstanding health care and in doing important research like that at the VA.
But let me put in a little balance on that from my viewpoint. Again, there's a huge difference between the ethics and standards in general medical care and in psychiatry. And I've had a fair amount of medical legal exposure to VA psychiatric care, and it turns out by and large to be a horrendous drug mill where the services that the vet coming back suffering from the trauma of war gets is, maybe a few groups here and there, maybe a little counseling, but maybe five psychiatric drugs at once that make it impossible for the vet to benefit. And I just think it's just for my audience, I do think there is a big difference between medicine in general, its ethics, its standards, and my field of psychiatry, which is attempting to treat psychological and social issues medically, which presents at the start a supreme difficulty to overcome. But you probably don't get into a lot of psyche. You probably don't have a lot of familiarity with the VA psychiatric services, would be my guess.
No. I can't speak informedly on that. But in terms of your other question about essentially, which is a big data question with medicine.
Yeah.
And I think I can't say that I have any specific alarm or fear, except the general kind of concern I have as a citizen living in a free society. And I think that we all have a certain amount of trepidation about everything with respect to our privacy as we move forward. And I think we all should have a healthy amount of trepidation about that, because it doesn't seem like a week goes by that we don't hear about credit card information being hacked or some kind of data breach of some kind. And of course, with healthcare information, well, that's a very fundamental private part of ourselves. And you can see there are all sorts of ways that data like that can be horribly manipulated and used in ways for which it was never intended. And so I think that not just healthcare providers, but I think we all really should take it upon ourselves to watch these developments very, very carefully and to be protective of our healthcare information. And so to be wary of that when you go to see the doctor and to have an idea of exactly how the healthcare information that you have is stored with your healthcare provider. Most electronic health records, most systems are moving, of course, to electronic health records away from classic paper charts. And electronic health records, I think, by and large, for the most part, are secure. But I think most computer experts will tell you that they'll pose that question, is any system truly secure? And I'm not an expert on that by any means. But I think that I know enough as a healthcare provider and a patient that I think we should all be wary.
Kelly, we're getting near the end. It's been a pleasure to have you on, and I wish you great luck with, not luck. I mean, you're beyond luck now. His book is Doing Harm. His name is Kelly Parsons. It's a medical thriller. My wife says it's a great read, but much more important than that, Stephen King is tweeting that it's a book for his hundreds of thousands of followers to read, and maybe we'll see a movie in the next few years on doing harm. And I really much appreciate your being on the show. I want to finish up with just two thoughts of my own as I say goodbye. One is, Kelly's a real example of pursuing your dream, you know, in terms of writing and doing the work, taking the lumps, getting past all the shame of having rejections. It's really, really so important in our lives to do that. We want to have satisfying lives. And then I want to remind you again, coming up October 29th and 30th here in Syracuse, a conference on ADHD and kids. The second day, the 30th, I'll be emceeing, but I'm going to be there the whole time. It's co-sponsored. The real hard worker and the force behind it is Michael Gilbert. Look it up on It's About Childhood and Family. Kelly, 30 seconds, a word about folks who want to write novels? No, nope, you don't even have the 30.
Pursue your passion. Follow your dream. Don't let the naysayers keep you down. It might sort of flirt with cliche a little bit, but I've got to tell you, it's all true. And you really have to listen to that inner voice. And if the inner voice is telling you that even though it's 5 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday and you feel like turning over and going back to sleep, you know, why not get up and write a couple pages? If that inner voice is really telling you that that's what you got to do.
Thank you so much. Kelly Parsons, author of Doing Harm. Bye, folks. Another good show. I'm so glad you're listening.